listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, in our weekly conversation with Professor Luciana Bone, we're going to step away temporarily from our discussion of the history of the Soviet Union. So this week we're going to do a little switch up, and there's so many contemporary issues that relate to this history that are popping up around us that we keep, you know, stepping out, particularly this whole thing with Russophobia. I mean, if we're discussing a history of the Soviet Union and starting in 1905 or whatever, yeah, the West is very deeply involved in everything that happened in Russia and in the other republics as well that became part of the Soviet Union, and was very involved and probably the key in taking down the Soviet Union and then looting it in the 90s. And now, as Russia has put itself back together and reclaimed some of its own sovereignty, particularly the U.S., but also the Europeans, the colonial powers, they're all going bananas and ready to blow up the world over this. So we're going to talk, I guess, about some of the more contemporary things right now, and we can invoke some of that history, and then we'll get back to the history. There's plenty to discuss.
Very good.
Yeah.
Today, so we're going to talk about distorting Russian reality, the present day, and the pushing of Russophobia, yeah, as you indicated in the beginning today. So we're stepping out of the sequential history of the Soviet Union into Russia and just looking at the Western powers' treatment, led by the United States, incitement to Russophobia. So I begin. So I'm going to ask you, Don, some questions, because I know you have facts at the tip of your fingers, and I want to do this today, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, good. So, I begin by quoting James Petras, who teaches at SUNY Binghamton and is a prominent political analyst of the left in the alternative universe to the mainstream media, to mainstream analysts and, you know, regime scholars. Right. So I quote him. Recently, I think it was this August, a recent article. Mm. So he says, even crazy leaders speak truth to power. President Trump has denounced and exposed the repeated deceits and ongoing fabrication of the mass media. Never before has a president so forcefully identified the lies of the leading print and TV outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, NBC, CNN, ABC, and CBS have been thoroughly discredited in the eyes of the larger public. They have lost legitimacy and trust. Where, he continues, where progressives have failed, a warmonger billionaire has accomplished speaking a truth to serve, he says, perhaps many injustices.
Right.
I'll skip the last part. But my question is, do you agree, Don, that the mass media's demonization of Russia, for example, is failing and has lost legitimacy with the public?
Well, I mean, you know, first of all, let's look at their own polling data. Mm-hmm. As recently as June, okay, and I'm surprised the numbers are this high. The mass media and Professor Petras went through a pretty exhaustive list. Fox was notably missing from that, but Fox suffers from the same numbers. The reverse way it breaks by party, but in June, a poll of 4,000 adults, roughly 4,000 adults, showed that 92% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents said that traditional news outlets knowingly report false or misleading stories, at least sometimes, and that that's in line with other recent polls from Gallup and Pew and others. It found that independents who identify as Democrats or lean towards Democrats, 79% of them feel that way, and just outright Democrats agree by 53%. In the aggregate, 72% of Americans believe traditional major news sources report news they know to be fake, false, or purposely misleading. So, now that includes a lot of folks who, you know, went through the entire system, did everything that they were supposed to do, got rewarded for it, are still getting rewarded for it, because we're talking about 3/4 of the population, roughly, at 72%. So in there are people who chased, caught, and are sitting on top of the American dream. They also believe that the media lies. Now, people like us who pay attention to, you know, more than just our personal lives, we've been looking at the society and the things that go on, know that they lie because we've been watching them lie our whole lives. They lied about Vietnam, and then, you know, Daniel Ellsberg releases evidence that they've been lying. There's a dance that's done. A whole bunch of stuff goes on around that. They try to kill him instead of absorbing the fact that they've been lying. And, you know, there's a few million bodies that are a consequence of that. You can go down to Reagan and the whole thing that happened with Iran-Contra and all of that. And probably the best measure of the reaction to the exposure of all of that, which was not exposed by the media, is that the one media person from the independent media who exposed some of it ended up dead. And then, you know, we're talking about Gary Webb. Then you've got the whole thing with the Iraq War, the first Iraq War in 1990, when it turns out that the media all report this thing with babies and incubators and horrible things done by that evil, nasty Saddam Hussein. It turns out this was stuff at a press conference that came from a press handler that was a member of the royal family of Kuwait, who was looking to have the U.S. Army go back and grab a few billion dollars of the Iraqi people's oil to put it back in his bank account and put that little princess back in her palace. And then we had what happened with the media from left to right, sideways, going into the Iraq war. And again, we already had amassed 1 million or 2 million bodies before that even started, between the people that were killed in 1990-91 and then starved slowly for a decade. And the whole media lied. The whole political establishment lied. People died. They're still dying. The troops are still over there. And yet, there's really never been any accountability for all of this. Well, this all happened in front of the whole world, including even those dumb Americans. And they're finally catching on. Then the economy collapsed in 2008. And they elected a guy. They were so desperate to solve the problem, they elected the black guy. Who would have thought in 2007 that that was possible? Not that it shouldn't have happened, but knowing the Americans, the most racist society on the planet, that it did happen showed that people were willing to try anything because they didn't trust their institutions. And then he and his government and the media started telling them for the next 8 years that everything was fine now. Well, people can believe it for a little while, just because it's repeated over and over on television, but when their stomach starts saying, hey, you know, I haven't eaten in a couple of days, and by the way, we're not living indoors anymore, they notice it. And if the TV's still telling them everything's fine, they stop trusting the TV. And it got so bad that they elected the reality TV guy who did nothing up until 2016 in front of them but fire people. But he said, I'll get you a job. They said, you know what? We can't believe any of them. The media hates him. There must be something good about him. So in terms of him saying, and, you know, whether it's the phenomenon of, you know, broken clock right twice a day or whatever, when Trump says the media is the enemy of the people, the corporate, when he's talking about CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, you know, this corporate media that belongs to the billionaire set, when he calls them the enemy of the people, he's right, because they have proven themselves that repeatedly. This is not the press. This is a public relations propaganda arm of the corporate reality that we live in. And that is, in fact, the enemy of the people.
Quite right. Yes, lies have killed millions.
Millions.
And starved people at home, and so on, and you put it very well. So I want to ask you a second question, and this concerns the professional, scholarly class, the people that belong to think tanks, that write books that become bestsellers, the regime, the people I call the regime Sovietologists at Yale, Harvard, etc. And my question is that some of them, one is from Yale, Clapton, I think is his name, claims that Russia was a democracy for the first time in its history under Yeltsin. Now, we know that from these think tanks and universities, these absurdities spill into the mass media. These think tanks and intellectuals are the conduits, are the generators of what becomes mass media lies. So Russia was a democracy for the first time in its history under Yeltsin. What do you say to that?
There's a compound word that begins with bull and ends with the first part of a compound word that President Trump used to describe some other nations. It refers to a popular fertilizer, that would be the first thing that I would say. And secondly, I would say a steaming pile of it. to convey the idea effectively that it may. Okay, so you have a country that is, in essence, an empire that has a bunch of people living as serfs, essentially in medieval property relations, with an industrial base also that is sort of on the periphery of the real imperial colonial powers. It's the eastern part of Europe, a large chunk of Asia. You can see London from your front steps, and from your back porch you can see Tokyo. It's called Russia. The people there have such a raw deal that in 1905 they tried to square it away, to fix it. There were people ready to take up arms and fight all over the country in 1905, and they failed. But one of the things that they did do was organize themselves into workers' councils, particularly in St. Petersburg and in Moscow and some of the other larger cities in Russia. Over a period of time, these were organized, and you essentially had working people, particularly factory workers, proletarians, learning how to govern themselves, in their own organizations, and taking care of many of the material needs of the working people that were not being met by the employers and the factories. And by 1917, in the midst of a war that had devastated not just Russia, but the whole of Europe, there was another uprising. This time was successful. There was a multi-class group that took power in the early part of 1917. And then under the guiding hand of Lenin, the working class elements found their way to power by what would now be called November, but what they called October of 1917. Those folks then set to build an economy that they owned and a government that served them. And it lasted from then until 1990, despite being destroyed twice and threatened with nuclear devastation and surrounded and completely and totally isolated from the global economy. Despite all of that, it thrived for a very long while, put the first people into outer space, did so many things that, just as an aside, helped the people of Cuba remain liberated from the United States, who in turn liberated millions of people in Africa from colonialism. The tremendous things that were done by it. There were many problems in the Soviet Union. I would guess the majority of them were a consequence of the warfare that was conducted against it, which they now call third and fourth generation, as if they were recent inventions. But sanctioning of the economy, the refusal even of the United States to recognize the Soviet government for 15 years after it took power, let alone extend credits back and forth to do the normal trading that every other nation does. So I would have to say that having built an economy that they owned at the close of business in 1991, and then finding out that people were going to steal it in broad daylight from them, seeing that happen, all of a sudden people that were living indoors, eating, had enough education, healthcare, and whatever to excel, let alone to get by, suddenly became completely and totally impoverished, insecure in every way, food, healthcare, housing, etc. I doubt any of them would refer to that period as their period of democracy.
Right. Right. Now, this is kind of a follow-up question. Question number three. Recently, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman wrote sarcastically that Putin must be a CIA agent, since he has done so much to hurt Russia. But IMF data points out that when Putin took over in 1998, per capita income was down by more than 40% since the 90s, since 1990s. More, this was higher than US, than the rate, than the drop in the U.S. Economy per capita during the Great Depression. Under Putin's administration, per capita income increased 115%, and average annual growth rate reached 3.9%. So how exactly has Putin served the CIA and hurt Russia, Don?
Well, first of all, if that were true, then I guess all of this money that they keep budgeting, like the 700-some-odd billion dollars that they're budgeting in the new NDAA over the last week or two, and the multi-hundreds of millions of dollars that they budgeted last year and the year before for a partnership with Russian thief Khodorkovsky and the CIA to propagandize. In other words, all this money that's being taken from Americans who can't afford health care to protect them from the Russian menace, I guess that money actually is being stolen because Putin has taken care of the job for us. I guess that's their argument. I don't know. Maybe it is. Maybe that's true. If it is, then let's start the trials and start, you know, prosecuting the people who are stealing that money. But it seems that they view Russia as an existential threat to their class. And somehow, with Putin having been president, he's on his third term, and he was the prime minister for a term in between. Somehow, with all of that time, in other words, he's been in power more or less since 1998, 1999, I guess that he's doing a really slow job of turning the country over to the CIA. The election earlier this year, there was a better than 76% turnout. In the United States, we have generally, 40 or 50 or something? I don't remember what we got in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, but he had 76% turnout, and he won, what was the percentage of the vote? Oh, no, I'm sorry. The turnout was 67.54%, and he won 76.69%, or almost 80% of the vote, more than three-quarters of the vote. The second best showing was by the Communist Party's candidate at 11.77%. So, you know, you had three-quarters of the people that voted, and two-thirds of every Russian of age did vote, saying, we think he's doing a swell job. Let's elect him yet again. And I don't know, maybe these people know more than the Russians do about their own candidates. But, you know, in the United States, you had a turnout, it was 55% in the Clinton versus Trump, with all of the, you know, propaganda and billions of dollars spent on that campaign and on and on and on. And Trump got 46.1% of the popular vote and Clinton 48.2. So, you know, in absolute numbers, now the population, the voting population in Russia is 109 million. I forget what the population is. It's like 150 million or something.
40?
Yeah. So there's 109 million registered voters in Russia. And Putin got 56 million and change of them. Okay, there are in the United States, do they even give us the number? How many registered voters are there in the United States? I don't know, but if you got 128 million people voted altogether. And that represents about 55%. So you have, what I said, 130. So it's about 230 million eligible voters in the United States, 230, 240 million. And the highest vote getter got 65 million. And again, Putin has, less than half the voter base, and he got about 85% of the total that they had. Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing the Russian people think he's doing just fine. And as a matter of fact, walking around Moscow, talking to people during the World Cup, as I did, that's what everyone there said. To the extent that I heard criticism, it was that he's not taking a tough enough stand with the United States doing the things that they're doing around the world. They would like to see Russia more engaged and more aggressive because, in fact, they're not aggressive at all, and they're being pushed around like the rest of the world by the United States. And Russian people, some of them, their nose is out of joint over it.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I'd like to point out is that the liberals, the liberal party, whatever it's called in Russia, gathered a miserable 2% of the vote. These are the leftovers from the democratic era
right.
of, what's his name?
Yeltsin and...
darling of, of indeed the CIA.
Right.
And if Putin is an agent of the CIA, he's costing the United States, as you pointed out, an awful lot of money, and he's not doing a very good job building up the Liberal Party. In fact, one of the things that was surprising about Grudinin and the Russian Federation Communist Party was two things. One was criticism of domestic policies.
Right.
Some of them pointing out facts of the slowness of things, like redeveloping the manufacturing. I don't have a list right here, but at any rate, the Russian Communist Party, which ran on its own, criticizes domestic policy, but completely adhered and to Putin's foreign policy and foreign defensive policy against the threat of the United States and its allies, and really, really echoed Stalin's position built in the 1930s as the Nazi attack was approaching, that is, build a strong military.
Yep. Yeah, and by the way, let's put this into context here. According to just about everybody, Russia, the United States, NATO, your Aunt Mary's cousin, Bob, everyone that looks at these things, Russia's military budget is somewhere between $35 and $70 billion a year, let's say for last year. The increase in the U.S. military budget this year over last year is almost that number. And the U.S. military budget itself is 10 times plus the highest estimate that they have of Russia. Russia, the highest one I'm looking at for 2016, that came out of Stockholm's, the International Peace Research Institute, they estimated Russia's military expenditure in 2016 at $69.2 billion. We signed off on a military budget the other day, the U.S. government, President Trump, it was at $717 billion, more than $700 billion.
Well, but you have to add to that the budget of NATO.
That's right, and the national budget.
$1 trillion, $750 billion contributed to by the U.S. So think about it, $750, that's only what's on the books. $750 billion military budget allocated to the Pentagon. Well, just come out of our pockets into the defense ministry or whatever you want to call it, And in addition, 750 billion to the coffers of NATO.
Hey, let's look at this. This is, again, from Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, okay? And, but we can also, there's an Institute for Strategic Studies. I'm going to have to close on this because I can't believe it. We're almost out of time already.
Oh, dear.
The U.S. In 2017 spent $610 billion. The world total is $1.7 trillion, okay?
Yeah.
The U.S. has half of that. China, they estimate at $228 billion. Saudi Arabia, $69.4 billion. Russia, $66.3 billion. India, $63.9 billion. France, $57.8 billion. UK, $47.2 billion. Japan, $45.4 billion. Germany, $44.3 billion. And South Korea, $39.2 billion. Now, out of all of that, you have Russia and the People's Republic of China on one side. So you've got shy of $300 billion, and on the other, you have about $1 trillion lined up. That is currently what's being spent on the military. And so when you're talking about who's aggressive and who's planning an aggressive move in the future, you have to say that it's the United States and its client states. And the one thing you got to remember about Trump is, as he's been talking about not the U.S. cutting back its contribution to NATO, he has been invoking the 2% requirement of the GDPs of each of the NATO countries, which they have not been contributing, as a demand. He's been saying, if you guys want us to play with you in NATO, you got to be putting up, ponying up 2% of your budget. Because Trump's big job creator thus far has been the huge arms sales to places like Saudi Arabia. I know that he doesn't plan to continue that way, but it has helped him get from here to there. And this is something that's going to change the political situation in Europe if it's really pushed, because the people of Europe will not spend. All right, we're out of time. Luciano, we'll come back next week, maybe a little more contemporary stuff, and then we'll get back to business.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Don.
Thank you, too. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Sending humans into space has long required a national and even international effort to provide all the necessary financing and technology. But SpaceX's recent successes in hauling freight into orbit claim to challenge this paradigm. Can privatized space services make space exploration cheaper and easier? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Jeffrey Hoffman, an American astronaut and currently a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Hoffman, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, the world is still mesmerized by SpaceX's recent Falcon Heavy launch. It was certainly very spectacular. I've heard some people compare it to the launch of Sputnik or the landing on the moon. I wonder, though, as an engineer, do you think that was really such a major technological breakthrough, a major milestone in the history of space exploration?
No. I mean, it is evolutionary, but what SpaceX as a whole is trying to accomplish, I do think, is revolutionary. The idea of strapping together three first stages to make a more powerful rocket is not new. The U.S. has the Delta Heavy rocket, which has been flying for many years now. So that technology is not revolutionary. However, what SpaceX has accomplished is to make it a lot more affordable. The rough cost of a Delta Heavy, it's hard to know exactly, but it's in the order of $250 million. The Falcon Heavy can carry twice the payload of a Delta Heavy for about $100 million. And so it really is changing the paradigm of how much it costs to get into space. And that's the revolutionary aspect, I think, of what SpaceX is doing.
But Dr. Hoffman, I wonder if it's perhaps too early to say that, because I think the same arguments were made about the shuttle program, that it's reusable, that it's going to be so much cheaper than, let's say, the Soviet comparison. But then I got from your own lectures that shuttles turned out to be much more expensive because all the ground operations and how they were serviced, perhaps not very efficiently. I understand that this is how SpaceX markets its technology at this point of time, but can we really rely on those figures to be proven in time?
Well, you're absolutely correct that people are waiting to see, can SpaceX maintain the very aggressive launch schedule that they have and reuse a lot of these first stage rockets, which they've been recovering, because that's what the price reduction depends on in large part. So, yeah, it's still early days. What I can say, though, is what happened with the shuttle, it was a very complex vehicle. I mean, it was very capable. It was the most versatile spacecraft probably that we'll ever see. But it took a tremendous amount of care and maintenance. There were thousands of people involved in every shuttle launch, and that's where the money goes for people's salaries. And what SpaceX has tried to do is to simplify everything, to make it possible to turn around a launch, to reuse the first stages without thousands and thousands of people. So far, they've been successful, but as you say, it's early days, and we have to see, can they maintain the pace and do it while they keep a perfect reliability record.
Now, Elon Musk is known to be very good at marketing. This is how he sells his very expensive cars, which I would argue are not very practical at driving, but are very good for boosting your self-esteem. I wonder if he's also trying to sell not so much the product, but the imagined experience associated with it. Because when you think about all the footage and the video that we got from that launch, it's more about projecting a certain idea, a certain dream, rather than marketing the actual capacity that he wants to bring to the market.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, anybody in the space business was concerned about, is the rocket going to work? It was really important to be able to show that they could launch, recover the boosters, and get the payload into orbit. The fact that instead of just using a bunch of lead weights he wasn't carrying any real payload for money. I mean, nobody was launching a satellite on this, but you still have to carry a payload with the equivalent mass of a large satellite. And so the fact that he decided to launch his red Tesla with a mannequin astronaut in it, that was obviously marketing and very clever. And the general public got a real thrill out of it. And the idea one of the things that I hope comes out of a lot of what's happening in the private space market these days, because we have to remember, SpaceX is not the only one. It's an extraordinary time that we're living in. We have a generation of billionaires who are space nuts. They have a vision. You listen to Bigelow, to Musk, to Bezos. Their vision is that someday many, many people, human beings, are going to be living off the surface of the Earth. And I think that's really what's ultimately motivating him. There's easier ways to make money than developing a rocket company, but he has a vision.
They are not the only people who have vision. And I think just because they're billionaires, I don't see why their vision has to be given so much attention than compared, for example, your own vision. Because you have been into space five times. You completed four spacewalks. You helped fix the Hubble telescope. And yet what people would remember after this launch is an empty Tesla car with a dummy astronaut, rather than, for example, you or somebody else who is doing a real work there in space. Don't you think that people perhaps need to appreciate not how glamorous the space is, but how laborious it is?
You're misinterpreting. The purpose of the Falcon Heavy launch was not to put a Tesla into orbit. The purpose was to demonstrate that this new configuration, which is the first time that SpaceX has ever tried this, and they want to be able to use this to launch heavy satellites. When you have a new rocket, you have to demonstrate that it works. That was the critical part of the launch, and it was totally successful. Yeah, he decided to make it a little sexier by putting his red Tesla as the payload, but that was not the purpose of the launch. Now, when somebody wants to put a really heavy satellite into orbit, they can have certain confidence that the Falcon Heavy configuration has demonstrated that it can work successfully. And hopefully, that means that he'll be able to launch heavy payloads both for private companies and for the government, because this is important for NASA. NASA has a lot of heavy payloads, and if you can launch it for a third of the price of what you would have to pay on a Delta Heavy, you can get a lot more science done.
Now, Dr. Hoffman, just a few moments ago, you mentioned this new vision that Elon Musk and other space nuts, as you call them, have. And Mr. Musk in particular is talking about a space-faring civilization and a multi-planetary species. I suspect this is actually very similar to what you heard and imagined when you were growing up as a boy in New York, drawing all those rockets. And that was more than 60 years later. And yet we as humanity are still not there. Do you think Mr. Musk will see his vision, very bold vision, I have to say, realized in his lifetime?
Well, when he talks about millions of people living on the surface of Mars, I think probably not. That's a very expansive vision. Whether or not that will occur in the lifetime of anybody who's alive now, I honestly don't know. But the Falcon Heavy now has the capability of taking payloads to Mars, rather significant payloads. And, you know, one of the exciting things that's happened is that NASA, as a space agency, originally kind of was reluctant to get involved with the private sector, but that was, I think, one of the successes of the Obama administration's space policy, was that they basically directed NASA to work with the private sector for low Earth orbit launches and for taking crew up to the International Space Station. And so this idea of a public-private partnership, I really look at as being the key to success for the future. We're not going to have another Apollo program, whether for the moon or Mars. I mean, Apollo was a very special time. We had a Cold War going on between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Space had been identified as one of the areas in which you could demonstrate the superiority of your culture, and you know, the Russians were launching things first, and then the Americans, and finally we got to the moon first, but at a tremendous cost. I mean, at the height of the Apollo program, over 400,000 people were working on Apollo. It was, for about 2 years, NASA was getting almost 4% of the U.S. government's budget. That's not going to happen again. So NASA, if they're going to be successful in space exploration, has to learn to do it not Apollo style, but affordably. And I think, therefore, there's a lot to be learned from the public sector. And by working with the public sector and using these developments, particularly the rockets and the spacecraft, developed at a much lower cost than NASA has previously been paying for launches, that might make it possible on a much more limited budget than we had during Apollo to get started with real space exploration again. That's what I hope will happen.
Dr. Hoffman, we have to take a short break, but we will be back in just a few seconds. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Jeffrey Hoffman, an American astronaut and now a professor in MIT's Department of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Now, Dr. Hoffman, just before the break, you mentioned that SpaceX already has the capability of transporting cargo and perhaps humans to Mars. I wonder if figuring out the transport capability is enough to commence on this very, I assume, dangerous voyage to the red planet?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, there's a whole slew of things. I mean, radiation, how we're going to deal with the radiation exposure. Just something simple like keeping food viable for 3 years. I mean, there's all sorts of things that NASA is looking at that problems that need to be solved, to say nothing of the, the psychology. How are we going to keep people healthy physically? I really think it's important that we first go back to the moon. It's been almost 50 years since we've had human beings on the surface of another planetary body. And Mars is very hard, which isn't to say that the moon is easy, but it's a lot closer, it's easier to get to, you can come back relatively quickly if something goes wrong. And many of the things, not all, but many of the things that we have to accomplish on Mars, we could test out on the moon. I think the moon would be an excellent test bed. And with the exception of the United States up until the recent change in policy, every other space-faring nation in the world, Russia included, wants to go to the moon. And I hope that we could actually put together an international lunar exploration initiative, much like we have the International Space Station Consortium. And together, the countries of the world, cooperating with the private sector, could afford to get back into real space exploration. And I think that would create a lot of excitement.
It's interesting you say that because I'm sure you know that back in 2017, NASA and the Russian space agency Roscosmos signed an agreement to look into building the first lunar space station. And that's at the height of poor relationship that we currently have between our two countries. Why do you think the space exploration was somehow unaffected by all this political mess that divides our countries?
I think it's actually a cause for at least some optimism, not just talking about what we would like to do someday in the future with the moon, but the current activities on the International Space Station, where the two biggest players are the United States and Russia. And as you say, we have our problems on the ground, but I think it's very, it's a cause for optimism that still in space, we're each keeping up our parts of the bargain, and we seem to be getting along quite well. There's some hope that maybe when you get off the surface of the Earth and we're not arguing about little pieces of ground in the Middle East or wherever in the world, that we can actually behave more like members of the whole human race and work together.
You complained about the shortage of budgets that go into space programs, and I think that's even more the case for Russia than for the United States. But I wonder if those financial constraints actually provide for this cooperating experience, because the Russians need the Americans' money and the Americans need the Russian equipment or technology for the time being. Do you think that's a good arrangement, and does it provide any synergy apart from each of the sides getting what they want?
It provides a certain level of safety. Again, looking at the space station, we have two oxygen generating systems. We have two water production systems, and they're different. And if one somehow has a design fault and breaks down, you have a certain level of safety by having different types of engineered systems. And this would be particularly the farther away from Earth you go, the more important the reliability becomes. On the space station, if we have a failure of a piece of equipment, we can send up something else to replace it. Or if the worst comes to worst, it's pretty easy to come back to Earth in a hurry. You go to the moon and you're much farther away from help. And if you've gone to Mars, forget it. There's no way. If something breaks, they can't send you a spare part. So to have two differently type engineered systems really provides a lot of extra safety.
Now, a few minutes ago, you sounded very excited about this infusion of private money into space exploration. And I think many experts believe that somehow private money can come to almost substitute national budgets as far as space program is concerned, or space programs are concerned. Do you believe that's realistic to expect that you can continue exploring space by the use of private money rather than relying on state budgets?
NASA's budget is a little over around $19 billion a year. That's a lot more than even, you know, Jeff Bezos puts about. He said he puts about $1 billion a year into his Blue Origin company. He sells $1 billion worth of Amazon stock, and he's got plenty of Amazon stock to sell. The real question is, what's going to motivate them? You're not going to make a profit by exploring Mars. And the government does it not to make a profit, but because traditionally governments have sponsored scientific missions. But if you look at the history of exploration, earlier on in previous centuries, there was a lot of private sponsorship of exploration. Again, what I hope will happen is that we'll have a mixture of public-private investment in this. How much the private sector wants to put into it depends on what they will do. You know, do they need to make a profit from it? I mean, Jeff Bezos has said, you know, he runs the Amazon business because that provides enough money for his space company. He's motivated by his work in space is not really to make a profit. But when you look at what's happened over the last few years, it has truly been revolutionary. We have seen a tremendous amount of innovation, just the idea of being able to reuse parts of the rockets. NASA tried to do that with the shuttle. Economically, it was not a complete success. But NASA was never, on its own, probably was never going to develop the ability to reuse parts of the rocket or even to substantially bring down the cost. Up until SpaceX came into the game, NASA's launches were all with the United Space Alliance, which was a monopoly created by Boeing and Lockheed. And they had no real motivation to reduce the cost of flights because they were getting their contract, basically they had no competition and they were getting a cost plus contract. So the more the launch costs, the more profit they got. Now we have real competition and rocket companies all over the world, not just Boeing and Lockheed, but Ariane Space, Roscosmos, the Japanese, the Indians, the Chinese, everybody is concerned. Can we compete with SpaceX? So it's really been revolutionary. And it's led to a tremendous amount of innovation, which I do not think we would have had if it had just been the government involved.
Now, I heard you say in one of the interviews that private companies such as SpaceX or Blue Origin are willing and able to take more risks than NASA or any other government agency. Do you think governments should play any role in determining the parameters of that risk, just as a matter of public safety? Because I think we would agree that launching a vehicle into space may represent certain risks.
No, they do. In order for SpaceX, Blue Origin, any or Boeing or Lockheed, I mean, any private company needs to get government approval before they launch. And of course, the government approval is mainly to make sure that they don't hurt anybody on the ground. We don't want rockets falling on the land near big cities or anything, and they need to get the, right now it's the Federal Aviation Administration that has authority to approve commercial launches. When it comes to launching people, the first people who are going to get launched in the SpaceX, and Boeing is also making it, its own private capsule, space capsule. They're going to be launching NASA astronauts, and there, of course, NASA will determine the safety conditions that have to be met. And I think, as far as flying the general public, if NASA decides that these vehicles are safe enough to fly NASA astronauts, then probably the Federal Aviation Administration, which frankly doesn't have a lot of expertise in human spaceflight, will say, well, if it's good enough for NASA, then it's good enough for us, and then they'll give approval to fly other members of the public. We talk maybe about the birth of a space tourism industry. Still early days, we don't know if it's all going to happen, if it's going to be successful, but this is the long vision that a lot of these companies have. You know, Bob Bigelow will put a space hotel up there, and SpaceX will launch paying tourists to go up, and it won't be inexpensive, especially at first, but there's plenty of people who would love to go into space, and they may have a chance in the next generation.
They want to go into space, even if that represents a certain risk to their lives. I want to ask you specifically about calculating those human risks, because I heard from a number of experts that especially after the loss of the shuttle Columbia, NASA has become more risk-averse than before. But on the other hand, I've also heard many American astronauts and Russian cosmonauts say that they understand that space exploration is an inherently dangerous undertaking, and they are ready to take certain calculated risks for the sake of common good. Do you think the agency, especially in the United States, is balanced enough between, protecting people and providing a certain space for exploration, which will always contain a certain degree of risk?
Well, we would like the next generation of human space vehicles to be safer than the shuttle, and the one big thing there is that they will have a launch escape system, which the shuttle did not have. So had there been a launch escape system, the Challenger astronauts would have survived, even though their shuttle was destroyed. When the shuttle was designed, it was designed with so much redundancy that people managed to convince themselves that it would be safe no matter what happened. And therefore, since you could always get the shuttle back, the crew would be safe as well. Well, that turned out not to be the case, and I don't think we'll ever make that mistake again. When it comes to the question of will tourists be able to take those risks, well, tourists pay $75,000 to get a guided climb up Mount Everest, and people have died. You know, tourists have died on Mount Everest. So I think it's clear at least a certain subset of wealthy people who are looking for new experiences are willing to take a certain level of risk. And there will continue to be a certain level of risk in space flight. It's not yet as safe as flying in an airplane. But, in the early days of aviation, there were a lot more crashes. It was a lot less safe than it is now. I suspect the time will come. I don't know how long it will be in the future, when we don't think it's any more dangerous to get in a rocket than to get in an airplane. But that time is not now, and I don't know when that's going to happen. So there will be a risk in space flight, but I think there are people who are willing to take those risks.
Well, you're certainly one of them. Dr. Hoffman, we have to leave it there, but I really, really appreciate your being with us today and sharing your thoughts and your expertise, your experience. And to our viewers, please keep the conversation going on our social media pages. As for me, hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.